Good evening. Welcome to Harbor Center and to our lecture tonight. I hope all of you know that there's coffee, there's tea, there's sugar outside. So if you need a little boost and then a little downer, help yourself. My name is Ellie Stebner, and I hold the J.S. Woodsworth Chair in the Humanities at Simon Fraser. The event tonight is hosted by the Interfaith Summer Institute for Justice, Peace, and Social Movements. And we're able to host this event because of the support of the Institute for Humanities at Simon Fraser, and I hope many of you have heard of the Institute for the Humanities, and also because of monies through the Woodsworth Endowment Fund. The purpose of the Woodsworth Endowment Fund is to support educational and community development efforts among individuals and communities. And certainly the Interfaith Summer Institute aims to do this. We are very excited about our upcoming program, which will be scheduled and hosted August 4th to August 12th. The interim director of our Interfaith Summer Institute is Denise Nadeau. Denise, do you want to just stand and yes. And I do think there are a number of members of the Consultative Community Committee, which is a very fancy title for the people who do the work. Do the two of you that I see want to just stand so that people know that you're on this committee as well? Is that okay? Because it is such an exciting program, and because the lecture tonight leads into it and some of the many things that we want to talk about, I do, I mean, it may sound like a radio show, but I do want to say check us out at www.interfaithjustpeace.org. It's org. So again, please welcome, please be welcome to our event tonight.
We've got flyers.
Where are our flyers?
On the table.
Madeline McIver, who is from First Nations House of Learning, UBC, and a member of our working group, will now have the pleasure of introducing our honored guest for tonight. Thank you.
We live in really, really complicated times, and it seems that conflict and violence is an increasing part of those times. And often it seems that religion is at the center of that conflict and that violence. And some of us are kind of optimistic because we believe that while religion is often at the center of those conflicts, we also believe that religion can play a role in helping people work through that conflict. And I just wanted to acknowledge the Interfaith Summer Institute for its belief in that, and its belief in bringing community together around that. And bringing people from many different cultures, many different backgrounds, who are working towards the same goal. And I'm really pleased tonight that Terry Lynn Williams Davidson is here to speak with us about that in her own way. I first met Terry Lynn when she was a university student. She told me a story once about her high school. She went to high school in Haida Gwaii in Skidegut, and there was no computer science course at her high school. It was far too small, and there were no computers in her high school. And her principal, one year when she was in grade 12, brought his personal computer to the school, and she got interested in computer sciences that way. And she ended up coming to UBC and studying computer sciences. And I always think that that's a really powerful story, because we think about resources and the importance of resources in education and what can you do in a school that has no computers. Well, it's amazing that one person can make a difference in somebody else's life. And so I was talking to Terry Lynn, actually interviewing her for an article I was writing about Aboriginal people in sciences, and talking to her when she told me that story. And she understood the importance of information technology at a really deep level and understood right away what it could mean for things like Aboriginal languages, what it could mean for land claims, what it could mean for court cases. And those are the kinds of things she was thinking about when she was doing her computer science degree. Terry Lynn went on to do a law degree and was one of the founding members, probably the force behind the founding of EAGLE, which is, let me try to remember what it stands for, Environmental Aboriginal Guardianship Through Law and Education, which is a non-for-profit society that deals with Aboriginal environmental legal issues, and worked there for a number of years and then left to start her own company, White Raven, that also deals specifically with environmental Aboriginal legal issues. Terry Lynn is also deeply rooted in the lifeways of the Haida people. She's an incredible singer. It's just a real joy to get to hear her sing. She works with fiber arts as well, making beautiful creations. She sings. She's illustrated children's book. She's kind of, I actually went and saw her, what was it? What kind of dancing was that?
Oh, no.
I saw you perform. I'm trying to remember. With the castanadas?
Flamenco.
Flamenco dancing. She's a Renaissance woman. She's a Renaissance woman. Continues to be a Renaissance woman. So, and tonight we get to see part of that. So, Terry Lynn, we're looking forward to hearing you speak.
Thank you, Madeline. I feel like that was an archaeological dig of things that I don't even remember. So thank you very much to the Interfaith Summer Institute for the invitation to speak tonight. I wanted to begin with the prayer song, which is what we use to open ceremonies and events in Haida Gwaiin. It's to clean the air and to clean the floor. And really, it's to bring us of one mind so that we can leave behind what we've gone through today or what we've gone through in this week and go forward in a good way.
Oh.
Why heck, oh, come touch your way.
Begin by just introducing how I think I got here. My first passion is culture, and it's been a part of my life, my whole life, and I've been so amazed with culture and ceremony and art. And I've heard kids say when they see the bringing together of art and culture and ceremony, asking their parents, what kind of magic was that? And I think that we are creating magic when we do that, and everything that I've done has been motivated by a desire to protect and keep culture alive. But I soon realized that we wouldn't have culture if it wasn't for the land. And our Haida culture would be very different if we were living in a different place on this earth. And so I see that land is a direct reflection of our culture. I spent some time traveling in the United States 15 years ago and went to different ceremonies for 3 months. And I saw and heard of elder Navajo women and other women who were taking arms to prevent uranium mining. And that really inspired me to do something different and to protect the land. And so I committed from that point on to protecting the earth. So I want to begin by introducing the Haida worldview and hope that I can reveal to you the earth soul, or at least that earth soul that is a part of Haida Gwaii. And then talk a little bit about the work that I've done with the Haida Nation in protecting the land, and then close with some thoughts about what I think will be our next steps in moving forward with protecting the earth. In the beginning, before Haida Gwaii existed, it was a place of only supernatural beings. And those supernatural beings inhabited other dimensions other than the soul dimension that we know today. So these supernatural beings lived in the upper world, the sky world, and the undersea world. And the principle of them was power of the great shining heavens, or power of the atmosphere. Sinskana Gwaii is what we call it. People might think of Sinskana Gwaii as God. Other supernatural beings of the upper world are manifested in the various winds, and they have wonderful names and very graphic names, like he who takes the tops off of trees, or he who rattles the stones. Supernatural beings in the Haida worldview live beneath every point in every village of Haida Gwaii, and they manifest themselves in the physical realm as either raven killer whales or eagle killer whales, or perhaps even those beautiful five-finned killer whales who can circumnavigate Haida Gwaii in just a few seconds. Throughout the landscape, we see supernatural beings such as Isquanaya, or many ledges. And that is the supernatural being that inhabits my ancestral village of Skidans, and it manifests itself as a rocky ledge behind our village. And so while supernaturals manifest in the land and the waterscape, in the Haida worldview, resources are viewed as people equal to or greater than ourselves. So for example, we see all the beings that inhabit the water as animals, as people in their animal or inanimate form, such as the salmon people or the herring people or other ocean peoples that live in the great ocean depths. We call the beings in the forest forest peoples, or a direct translation from the Haida language would be the people of the supernatural being upon whom it thunders. Those are the beings that live in the ocean. There are also the grizzly bear people and the black bear people and all the beings that inhabit those beautiful old growth forests. And we call the cedar tree our ancient sister to recognize the fact that it is the cedar tree who provides for all of our material and spiritual and social needs. So we recognize that we have a relationship with the cedar tree as a sister to all Haida women. And in this world, it's a world where the beings can transform back and forth interchangeably between the different realms. And it's not so long ago that this transformation occurred. My grandfather saw a transformation of a large bird into a human being. And so it isn't that long ago that we didn't have such barriers between the different realms. Once Haida Gwaii came into being, it was called Haida Gwaii, or islands taken out of concealment from the supernatural beings. In other words, it became a place where the supernatural beings could inhabit instead of simply hanging off little rocky bluffs throughout the ocean. And I believe that because Haida Gwaii was first occupied by these supernatural beings, that it led Haida people to having a more caring relationship with the land. In the Haida worldview, the human relationship with peoples, the human relationship with the peoples of the oceans and the forests are regulated through female supernatural beings, such as creek women or mothers of the streams. And creek women live at the head of every creek, and they take care of the peoples that live in the creeks, or they take care of the health of the stream. So if we are to take salmon from the stream, then we need to pay respect to the creek woman before we can take any of the beings under her care. Similarly, low tide woman owns and takes care of all the shellfish and seafood and all the other beings that inhabit the low tide zone. So essentially, supernatural beings are gatekeepers, and they regulate our use of the fish and the seafood and the forests peoples. We have a strong mechanism to reinforce this worldview and relationship, and I think that this mechanism is perhaps what has kept our strength as Haida people, and that is art. And art, I believe, reflects our relationship to the land. It records our oral traditions. And art is really exterior proof of the complexity of our culture. And despite the legal system and popular beliefs that viewed our cultures as being not sophisticated enough to hold property, which I'll come back to later, the art shows that, in fact, we did have a very complex relationship with the earth and a very complex social structure. Art connects people to the spirit world, and so artists such as my husband will tell me that through the creation of art, he's able to tap into that Sinsranagwai, or the supernatural being of the atmosphere, or God. And so through that connection, he can bring truths and reveal it to people if they're willing to see what the art reveals. Similarly, I've been told by weavers like Cheryl Samuel that every stitch that you take is a prayer. So the actual creation of the art is actually a communion with Sinsganahwai. And so when you take this, the power that's already inherent in the art, and you use it to demonstrate oral traditions through song and dance, it helps to connect people in a greater way than you would be able to do otherwise. And it connects us to the land, and it connects us to the spirit world. And through our ceremonies and the bringing out of treasures and art, we reaffirm our ties to the different parts of the landscape of Haida Gwaii and the ocean. Our names and crests and stories and songs and dances and the visible manifestations of that, our clan masks and our blankets, are perhaps the most important kinds of wealth that we own. And because it is so important, people were and are raised to assume the responsibilities to maintain that wealth. So people like song custodians or storytellers or artists are taught at a very young age to keep alive this most important wealth of our culture. I learned of this wonderful story of Charles Edenshaw, who was a famous Haida artist, who when he would wash his hands, he would have others put their hands beneath him so that the power of creation of the hands would go into the person holding their hands beneath them.
And so I think that's a wonderful image to think of passing on the tradition of art and recognizing the power that we have and to pass it on to the next generation. This beautiful wealth, the intangible wealth of songs and dances and ceremonies, was exchanged between clans or nations in what we call a potlatch. And it isn't just an exchange of wealth, but actually it is a place to solidify political relationships. So for example, sometimes canoes in the past and even today are given at potlatches. And that exchange, as well as the canoes themselves, help to connect us to our neighbors. So if we gave a canoe to the Kwakwaka'wakw people, then we're tied to the Kwakwaka'wakw nation through the gift of the canoe. So the potlatch is our central institution. It is here that we inherit or assume new intangible cultural heritage, like the songs and the dances and the ceremonies, or actual physical property in the potlatch realm. And through that, the potlatch was essential to maintaining our ties to the land. So this is how we saw our relationship to the land, with the supernatural beings occupying the whole landscape, with the resources being actual people, and then having women supernatural beings who regulated our use of those resources, and then having those ties being reaffirmed in a political realm like the potlatch. So I find that to be a very sophisticated way of using and regulating access to the resources. So how does that contrast with Canadian regulations and uses of natural resources? I want to just talk briefly about Canada's history of suppression of Aboriginal peoples and give a very brief introduction of Aboriginal law in a very few minutes. It's almost as condensed as Cole's notes. In Canada, the legislative authority for Indians and lands reserved for Indians rests with the federal government. In 1885, the federal government enacted the Indian Act, which regulates and regulated all activities on reserves. In 1927, the federal government amended the Indian Act and made it illegal for us to assemble publicly, made it illegal for us to raise funds for litigation, or to retain legal counsel to represent us in reaffirming our ties to the land. This legislation remained in Canadian law until 1952. Now, this was during a time when, in addition to those legal prohibitions, there were three other facts that we need to recognize. And the first is that our children were removed to schools far from our homes. And in many cases, their innocence was violated through sexual and physical abuse. And with this abuse, their willingness to seek Indigenous knowledge and our worldview of the lands and resources. Secondly, within the Haida Nation, we experienced great loss to our numbers. So we lost 90% of our population, and that was resulting from smallpox and tuberculosis. So actually, over 17 different clans on Haida Gwaii became extinct, and with them, their ties to certain parts of the territory. Our ancestors' final resting places were also excavated, and their remains and associated burial objects were removed to institutions in faraway lands. And our repositories for cultural knowledge and ceremonies, our art and our cultural treasures, were also removed. So we have the legal prohibitions and then these very deep-reaching impacts into our culture. But despite all of that, our connection with the land continued through beliefs and customs, which may not have been so apparent to people who observed those customs, such as paying respect to the ocean beings every time we go to take seafood from the low tide area, or being very careful with how we talk around those peoples, being very careful about how we talk to around the clams or the salmon. And while songs and stories and dance were not brought out in the open in the potlatch realm, the people who were raised to keep those songs and dances and ceremonies alive continued to do so and recorded those songs for us to learn from. So my great-grandmother was a song custodian for the village of Skidans and then Skidiot, and she kept alive the songs and passed away in 1970 at the age of 109. Our potlatch ceremonies, while they were legally prohibited and we didn't have potlatches for a long time period, they were disguised and went underground. which meant that we would disguise them as Christmas dinners. So Christmas dinners became very important to us, where we would follow all the protocol of inviting certain guests and seating them different ways and having them speak in the order of how they would have spoken traditionally in potlatches. Other more private ceremonies, such as burnings to pass on possessions to someone after they passed away, remained in place and weren't under such scrutiny. Our cultural roles, such as the aunt's roles in life cycle events, continued. Or sometimes we created new ceremonies that held the place, if you will, of old ceremonies. So for example, we have headstone raising ceremonies, which in essence took the place of totem pole raisings when we were discouraged from raising totem poles to commemorate someone's life. It's also important to note that there are elements of our culture and our property systems that remained in place within a Western vessel. So for example, part of a wedding ceremony is to engage in a very long and involved grinding of tobacco with clamshells, and then that's distributed to the opposite clan. Well, in Haida weddings, in the up until the last generation, because we didn't have the tobacco grinding ceremony anymore, people would often find cigarettes on their table, and that was to symbolize the giving of the tobacco, an important thing in Haida culture. So most people would look at that and wouldn't recognize the deeper cultural ties that exist within that cigarette. So I have looked at that, and I've seen that this suppression has impacted us, but I've also seen that it's like a waterbed effect. So if you push down by enacting legislation that tries to prevent our ties to the land, that the energy surfaces in another way. And so it surfaced in other ways. So for instance, the Haida people participated and in some instances led to the creation and the carrying on of province-wide political organizations and activities. Throughout all this time, the Haida people have questioned the colonial government and then the province of British Columbia and asked the federal government, how did you get ownership to Haida Gwaii? These questions still remain unanswered to this day. So I'd like to talk very briefly then about Canadian law. In Canada, with the early settling of Canada, it was a principle of international law that the federal governments and the colonizing governments would recognize that indigenous peoples own the land, and it was necessary to engage in a treaty process in order to purchase the lands or gain title to the lands. So as I've said, the federal crown assumed the responsibility for Aboriginal peoples. So they assumed the responsibility of purchasing lands from Aboriginal peoples and didn't allow settlers to purchase directly from us. This role was incorporated into Canada's Constitution Act of 1867. However, our title over lands and resources was invested in the provinces with an important limitation. It was subject to, and I quote, any other interests other than that of the provinces. As early as 1880, courts have confirmed that this meant as well that provincial crown title was subject to Aboriginal title, that Aboriginal title was an interest other than that of the provinces. So we see there, by looking at this interpretation of the division of powers in Canada's constitution, that the province doesn't have the underlying title to any of the lands in British Columbia until it disencumbers its title and enters into treaties with Aboriginal peoples. The Dominion government therefore began to negotiate treaties across Canada, but it and the British Crown ran out of money literally when it reached British Columbia. And so the matter was left to British Columbia. One of the conditions for the colony of BC joining Confederation was that it needed to have kept sufficient land aside from Aboriginal peoples. Well, of course it hadn't. There may be large reserve size in the rest of Canada, but here in British Columbia, we have quite small reserves. The reserve that I grew up in, the village of Skidiot, is really, when I was growing up, there was no more than 3 city blocks long, and that was supposed to be enough to sustain the 500 people. Without funds to conclude treaties in British Columbia, an absent conquest or absent cession, a new principle was needed to assert sovereignty, to attract and permit settlers to capitalize on the wealth and resources and land of British Columbia. One aspect of the international doctrine of discovery provides that land is discoverable if it is unoccupied. So the words they use is if it's terra nullius. And that's even where indigenous peoples occupied and used those lands, but that's where the indigenous peoples, in their view, did not possess a certain degree of political or social organization. So in other words, if indigenous peoples were not capable of holding title or were not sophisticated enough to have a relationship with the land, then therefore the land would be vacant and free for the taking. So relying upon this principle, Canadian courts have held that the Crown gained, the federal Crown, gained the underlying title to the lands and resources of Canada. And in the case of British Columbia, the provincial government would gain title and jurisdiction over lands and resources when it disencumbered its title of Aboriginal title. But in spite of that limitation on provincial powers, and despite courts saying that the province doesn't have free and clear access to the resources, the provincial governments have granted rights to third parties to occupy, log, fish, and mine British Columbia. This was a huge concern for Aboriginal peoples and, of course, for the Haida Nation, and it led to national pressure to include Aboriginal rights and title in Canada's Constitution Act of 1982. So Aboriginal peoples have worked hard to push for our rights to be recognized in Canadian law, and it's our view that the province's power over natural resources is not a full and complete title. Collectively, we've been trying to address that very issue in litigation for the past 30 years. We've been trying to raise the issue of how did the province get the underlying title to lands and resources, but we haven't been able to squarely challenge that issue in courts, and it's a matter that is now presently before the courts, and hopefully we'll have a decision on that matter in the next year or so. So what is Aboriginal title? In 1997, the Supreme Court of Canada finally confirmed that, among other things, Aboriginal title exists in Canada. So they disagreed with the province of BC, this province's government, who went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada saying Aboriginal title doesn't exist in British Columbia. It never did, or if it did, we extinguish it through enacting our various legislation and regulations over natural resources. So the Supreme Court of Canada disagreed with them. The court held that Aboriginal title is an exclusive right to occupy the lands, and it's an interest in the land itself. It's not just a collection of rights to hunt and fish and trap in specific locations. That was the other argument that the province made, was that title is really just little dots over the landscape to do certain things. It's not an actual interest in the land itself. The Supreme Court confirmed that Aboriginal title predates Canada's assertion of sovereignty, and that it's derived from our historic use and occupation of the lands. So the court looked backwards at our pre-existing title and our long relationship with the lands, and then they applied that forward and said that Aboriginal title has an important limitation to it, and they called it an inherent limit. So if we've maintained this connection with the land into the past, we also need to maintain that connection into the future. And so they said that any activities on Aboriginal title lands must allow present future generations to enjoy the same connection with the land that previous generations did. So essentially, that's a sustainability limit. The court is saying that we've got to keep this beautiful connection to the land that I talked about in place into the future. The court also identified an inescapable economic component. So along with title is a right to a livelihood and a right to make a living from the lands and resources. So this all sounds very well and good when we look at what the law actually says, and when we look at Canada's constitution and we see that it's protected and enshrined in our constitution, the soul of our land. But what has that meant on the ground? The province's response to that, the Delgamuukw decision and other decisions, other cases that the Haida brought, was, okay, well, so title exists, so you prove your title, and until you prove your title, we're going to consult with you about proposed developments. So typically that meant calling up Aboriginal peoples and saying, we're going to do this, what do you think, and hang up and not really consider what the concerns of Aboriginal peoples might be. If there was any consultation, and that was reflected in the various natural resource legislation in BC, it was consulting on a very piecemeal approach. So it was consulting on a very site-specific approach. So looking at small little permits or licenses to log here and there, or licenses to build a road, not looking at the whole landscape, a very site-specific approach. So this meant practically that all developments went forward in British Columbia. It meant that First Nations were literally overwhelmed with a mountain of referrals for cutting permits and logging permits, and we didn't have any real ability to protect our Aboriginal rights and title in the interim before we actually got to court to prove that we held title or to negotiate a treaty. So turning then to Haida Gwaii, in Haida Gwaii, all of the operable forests have been allocated to logging companies. In the 1980s, the Haida people and elders took direct action and brought international attention to Haida Gwaii. And the end result of that whole process was that a quarter of the land base of Haida Gwaii was protected in an area that we call Gwaii Hanas, or Place of Wonder or Beauty. And the Gwaii Hanas took a unique approach in that it acknowledged that there was a dispute over title and jurisdiction, but notwithstanding the differing views of who might own it and who had authority over it, that we shared common ground in the need to protect the rare biological and ecological and cultural treasure that was Gwaii Hanas. So with that agreement, we created a trust fund of $32 million that was used for and is used to this day for community development and bringing the communities together and building infrastructure. While the area is jointly managed with the federal government, essentially the Haida have a veto power in a management board, which has been held to be one of the strongest forms of co-management. The agreement has provided for training of Haida people, training in management of protected areas, managing others' relationship with the land in Haida Gwaii. Recently, a National Geographic survey found Gwaii Hanas to be the best protected area in North America based on the cultural experience that visitors would have and the limited or the restriction of numbers of people that go in, so you still have a really good wilderness experience in Gwaii Hanas. We're currently in discussions with the federal government to protect the surrounding marine environment of Gwaii Hanas as well. So we had a quarter of the land base of Haida Gwaii protected, and what about the remaining three quarters? The largest part of that three quarters was a large tree farm license that was owned by McMillan Bodell and then Weyerhaeuser, and it was granted in what we call the heartland of Haida Gwaii, what anthropologists and artists have called the bent box capital of the world. It's in Masset Inlet, where many of the fine old-growth cedars come from, and where we believe many of the bentwood boxes and canoes came from that area of Haida Gwaii. From that one license alone, over $30 billion of trees were taken from that license, and that's a conservative estimate of the market values. So if you try to visualize what that $30 billion looks like, one cubic meter is one telephone pole. And if you converted that, all of those trees into telephone poles and placed them end to end, it would be enough to go not once around the globe, but 20 times around the globe from that one logging license held by McMillan Bodell and Weyerhaeuser. So in the face of that destruction 20 years ago, the Haida began to unilaterally designate 14 areas throughout Haida Gwaii that were important to us to keeping Haida culture alive, to protecting the land in important places, either environmentally, culturally, or historically. These areas did not have any formal designation under provincial or federal legislation, but nonetheless, the companies and the provincial government didn't allow logging to occur in those areas. Now, when Gwaii Hanas was created, relationships between the communities were tense. We were blockading against a logging company and loggers who had jobs, who were trying to keep their families alive, and it was a hard time for many families. But over time, as the logging pace continued, the non-Haida people began to see the writing on the wall, and they began to see that the future would not be a long future on Haida Gwaii. They began to see that community stability and community sustainability was not in the interest of the logging companies and not in the interest of the provincial government. And so the communities of Haida Gwaii, Haida and non-Haida alike, formally advised the government that the island's wide cutting level was double the what was sustainable and asked for that level to be brought in half and asked for all the Haida protected areas to be removed from the whole cutting calculation of how much trees logging companies could cut. Despite that sort of islands-wide support for reducing logging on Haida Gwaii, the province refused to discuss those issues. They refused to negotiate those at the treaty process, the very process that we have in place for raising these issues. And they said that they didn't have any obligation to consult with us. They didn't have an obligation to talk about the cut levels with the Haida Nation. They didn't have an obligation to talk about what kinds of licenses would be granted, these big, huge logging licenses, or they didn't have an obligation to talk about how logging would be conducted on those lands. And they said they didn't have that obligation because their legislation didn't say that they had to. And they were bound by their legislation. And they said that instead, they would deal with Aboriginal rights and title through consultation at the permitting stage. Again, that whole referral process on a cut-by-cut basis. So clearly, that wouldn't be enough for us to protect culture, and it wouldn't be enough to protect Haida Gwaii. So the Haida Nation committed to bringing an Aboriginal title lawsuit. But we also recognize that that lawsuit would take many years to complete. The Dalgamuk litigation took place over 20 years, and $14 million is a conservative estimate for that litigation. And we knew that during all that time period, many of our trees and our ancient sisters would be taken from Haida Gwaii. And so in the interim, we challenged the minister's authority to issue that logging license. And we relied upon what I was telling you about the division of powers in Canada's constitution to say that the province didn't have any authority to issue the license to McMillan Bodell. You can't give what you don't own. So at every court level, we made these legal arguments, but we also told the court about the need for sustainability, and we told the court about the Haida worldview of the land, and we told them about the supernatural beings that inhabit the landscape and the oceans, and we told them about our ancient sister, the cedar tree. And the Court of Appeal decided in our favor, and they held that the entire forestry management regime likely infringed our rights, and they held that not just consultation is required, but significant accommodation of our interests. And when that occurs, it must not be just at the operational level, but at the strategic level when all the big decisions are being made about the resources. The province and Weyerhaeuser appealed that decision to the Supreme Court of Canada. And almost every province in this country intervened. The Government of Canada intervened against us. And practically all of corporate Canada intervened, from the Forestry and Mining Associations to the Cattlemen's Association and the Chamber of Commerce. In a surprising move, the village of Port Clements intervened on our side. And so this is a community that is primarily supported by logging. They were, their primary employer was Weyerhaeuser, so they were actually intervening on our side against their employer. And I think that was really in our favor to have them intervening on our side. So we have the province saying that you shouldn't decide in favor of the Haida because we represent the public interest and all these things will happen to the economy if you grant in favor of the Haida. And then we have the village of Port Clements saying, well, wait a minute, we're the most directly affected if you grant in favor of the Haida, and we support the Haida. We think that we've got a better chance at a long-term future on Haida Gwaii if we work with the Haida than if we continue along with this industrial development model. So the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in our favor, and they held that consultation must occur before we prove our title. So it isn't this terra nullius before we prove title in court. We actually have interests in the land. The court directed that, in our case, accommodation would be required, so a change in how logging would be conducted would be needed in order to protect our interests. The court also was clear that if the province can't meet its obligations to protect our interests, that they had an important tool available to them, and that was to amend their legislation. So they could amend their legislation to ensure that accommodation occurred and that protection of Aboriginal rights and title would occur. Well, the province amended its legislation, but not as you would think. They removed the requirement for their consent to transfers. They removed any opportunity where they would intervene and give consent for transfers, for replacements, for new licenses. They extended the time period when licenses would come up for replacement. And basically, they cleared the way for Weyerhaeuser to vacate that license. Weyerhaeuser then sold that license to Brascan. And so having spent 10 years in litigation, having had a decision in our favor in the Supreme Court of Canada, the Haida felt that they had no other place to go. And so they held a peaceful blockade, called and we called it Island Spirit Rising, in the spring of 2005. And actually, this blockade helped to further solidify relationships between Haida and non-Haida communities. So we had Haida and non-Haida people sitting around a fire and talking about our common future and exploring how we might find a path for us to walk together. Later that spring, the province and the Haida concluded an interim agreement to protect an additional 20% of Haida Gwaii. So that's most of the protected areas for a period of 3 years, and then to give temporary protection to the habitat of endangered species and cedar trees. Some of you may know that in Canada, the Species at Risk Act doesn't protect the habitat of endangered species. So this was a way for us to ensure that those our other relatives, those forest peoples, would be protected because we couldn't do it under existing legislation. Last spring, the province agreed to provide longer-term protection to the Haida protected areas and to the habitat, what Guja calls the birds and the bees. So we were able to, again, we're up at 53% of Haida Gwaii being protected before we've started negotiating a treaty or before we've finished our title lawsuit. So our strategy then has been to build alliances with local communities and to work out protocols on how we'll continue to work together in the future. We want to protect whatever we can in the interim, ideally through negotiation if we can, and if not that, then through litigation. We have a title litigation proceeding where we will prove title to Haida Gwaii as well as to the seabed. So our title to the seabed has not been proven anywhere in Canada, so it's a new issue that we'd be bringing forward. But we don't think it's enough just to prove who owns Haida Gwaii or to prove who's responsible for it. We want to also use the litigation to develop a model for sustainable coexistence within Canada. And so we would work with Haida elders and experts who would give opinions on what might this new model look like. How might we live off the land in a different way that provides for real long-term sustainability? If we have the possibility of reaching long-term agreements with the province and the federal government, then why would we need to engage in litigation, especially costly and time-consuming litigation? The two reasons for that, we have to be mindful of what the province and Canada's positions are against us in the title lawsuit. In the title lawsuit, both governments deny that we hold title to Haida Gwaii. Once again, they're still denying that. But even more shocking is they deny that we exist as a nation, they deny that we exist as a people, they deny that we were organized or sophisticated enough to hold title to the lands and resources. And I think secondly, even despite what they may file in court, until actual change filters down on the ground and on the land, we need to keep pushing forward without litigation. It's my personal belief, which may not be held by all First Nations, that we need to protect the land first. And once that's done, we can address rights, who owns it, who has authority over it, pursue litigation on rights, but let's first protect something for the future. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way, and we sometimes need to, in order to achieve protection, we've got to use adversarial tools like litigation to ensure that protection actually occurs, just to give the extra leverage to make sure it happens. But we can use those tools in combination with peacemaking tools like building community relationships, like visioning what our collective future might look like. So I think it's possible to use the master's tools, not to take down the master's house, but to build a new house that we would live in collectively in the future. I'm biased, but I believe that Haida Gwaii is a beautiful place, and it's a beautiful place and an important place for all peoples. It's a place of incredible beauty, and I think it's one of Canada's last remaining ecological jewels. And I hope that I've helped you to see the soul of Haida Gwaii through the different supernatural beings, and that relating with the land is not just, it's not just about something outside of you as an inanimate object, but it's like relating to another person. It's like seeing the soul of the land and relating with the land, recognizing that soul. I believe that we're truly at a critical place in our history, and that we cannot achieve peace within ourselves unless we achieve peace with the land, unless we find a new way. We need to protect the earth before we can achieve peace within ourselves. I began with a prayer song. And the words to the prayer song are, today there is no wind to push me. Today there is no wind to hold us back. Today we will go in our own strength. And I don't see that song so much as being that we go individually alone on our own strength, but that we build our strength by working with others, and through that process, we also find our own soul. So thank you.
So Terry Lynn has time for a few questions.
As long as it's not about flamenco. Oh, yes.
I think that was a wonderful presentation, and I think you could add to it that the IWA local on Ida Gwaii also recommended a 50% reduction, and they forwarded it to the Vancouver office, and it never went anywhere. So there was even an opposition in labor between what local people who were residents of Port Clement a lot and the central IWA, which had its own political agreement with the logging company.
Right.
It's amazing. Consistent.
Thank you for listening.
Somebody have a tough question?
We're just warming up, don't worry.
Do you believe if you were to ever succeed, as everybody's changing their views on what we need to do with the earth, that it could ripple out to other Aboriginal communities and transform other land situations?
I think so, but I think everybody is part of the solution, and everyone's bringing a different piece of the solution together in their own way. So I'd like to think that we could pull out principles that could apply to others, but I know that everybody, I have hope that everyone will develop their own solution as well.
It appears you're plenty strong enough to do all this on your own, but what can we do? Those of us who are urban, non-Aboriginal, ostensibly the public that these governments are representing, as you put it. If we resisted those governments, how would we go about it?
Well, I'm sure there are many things you could do. I've spent my efforts thinking locally and building communities locally, because I think we can build our own solution in Haida Gwaii with even without the provincial and federal government's involvement. And I think that we all have to start doing that within communities. I think we have to look at what we can do instead of what we can't do and find space for that, in the same way that the Gwaii Honest Agreement looked at what we could do instead of focusing on what we can't do. So I don't know. I mean, it's within... Each of us has some piece to contribute to what that might be. I don't know. I can't answer.
Well, I think you have two things. One is sustainability generally, but also in your particular case.
I mean, how do we support the Haida right now? Yeah, that's what's in my mind. How do we support the Haida right now?
Well, yeah, as we go forward with the litigation, it is a costly litigation. It is, we estimate $12 million to complete. And we'll have to keep working on that case, even though we might be negotiating with the provincial and federal governments in other processes. I'm not a politician, I'm a lawyer.
Thank God.
Yes?
Well, yeah. Is there a legal defense fund? It's a more specific question.
Well, the Council of the Haida Nation and Haida Tribal Society have a a litigation fund to bring the litigation forward. So I believe they have a website.
About what you said about all those billions of dollars that corporations made out of the trees, and then I was thinking, oh, like Sun Peak, it's and all the money that the province gave that disputed land for development, and somebody's going to make a lot of money out of that. And I was thinking, well, are those people just going to get away with stealing those resources from the people who own it? I mean, if the decisions come down in your favor, what about all that?
A part of the title case that I didn't speak about was pursuing a damage award for resources that were taken without lawful authority. Mm-hmm. And so a big part of the case is accounting for the resources that were taken, mm-hmm. and that would be part of the damage award that we are seeking in the litigation. Yes? Okay. I don't see myself as an artist, but I know an artist and question him about a lot of things. And in his view, he has sort of categorized the different levels of art. And so even traditionally, art was created for commercial trade. So we would create art that would then be traded with neighboring nations. And so the art that we now create that is now sold on the market in Vancouver is that kind of art. It actually has a traditional basis in it. There is also personal art that is created for our own personal identification. So, you know, the crests that I have on are my family crests, and it's created for me personally. There's also ceremonial art, which helps bring us to a ceremony that's relevant for us. But I think through all of that, I see the ability of art to touch someone in a way that might not be otherwise touched. And I think that if that engagement of another person allows them to see, to reach some form of enlightenment, then I think it's a good tool to get there. So I'm not personally opposed to people wanting to learn more about art, wanting to learn about a connection to the land that they may not have, if it helps to create, to open that door for them.
I wanted to ask you about the Ministry of Aboriginal Relations and Reconciliation and their approach right now to using that ministry to support land claims, the treaty process, I think. And from what I gather, this government is trying to rush forward the treaty process with not much luck, but there was all, this ministry's got all this dough to kind of make good relations. And what struck me most about what you, the lot struck me, because I didn't know any of your details, so I was just incredibly moved by what you described, but the idea of sustainability for your children in the future, like if we're going to talk about sustainability, you have to have the same for the children in the future as you had in the past. How can we incorporate those kind of much more deeper spiritual concepts into, I don't see any of that in what's going on right now with the reconciliation discourse of this government, right? And I'm just wondering, what do you recommend for people who want to support a deeper connection to the land than these type of strategies? Or I just was very struck by what you said, that what you're talking about is something totally different than what this government is talking about, right, with that ministry?
Well, I think the first way to support a connection is to actually get on the land. Like, there's nothing short of going there and being there and feeling it in your heart and being moved to tears by the beauty of it. And I would like to see more actual protection before we talk about money, before we talk about all the other issues, because we could go through this process, even if it is a fast track process, and at the end of the day we have less to work with, then it doesn't make sense to be throwing all of that money without having the protection first. So I think we've got to start from the ground level of protecting land, and once we achieve that, then move forward on looking at how we might work together with that. So
just because I'm aware of a lot of reconciliation processes being moved forward at community levels as well, then the demand we as allies would make is for, what's the legal thing for protection of the land? That's not a treaty process. What's the legal terminology for protection? What would we be lobbying for?
Well, there's all kinds of ways to protect the land. There's been large parts of BC protected under the Land Act in the mid-coast of BC. It could be, we actually can't protect land unless it's a sort of a temporary protection, is what the different cases have said. So if it's a temporary protection until such time as we resolve title and jurisdiction, then at least it's protected. I think that sort of answering that question and your question, one thing that people could push for is for the provincial government to amend the new forestry legislation. And so when I was talking about how the government amended all of its legislation, basically the Supreme Court of Canada told them, you've got a duty to consult and accommodate Aboriginal peoples. They said, we've got this duty, well, we're getting out of here. We don't want this duty. We'll leave all the decisions to industry. Industry can decide where they're going to log, how they're going to log, and we're not involved in that at all. So instead of amending the legislation to protect, they've just left it open for logging companies to protect. And not only that, it's possible that licensees could unilaterally declare areas that they could log and do whatever they want on over the land. So even though we've created a land use plan in Haida Gwaii or on the mid-coast, this declared area sort of trumps all of our work in negotiations and protecting, making a land use plan. So what's the point of having spent all these years creating a land use plan when a licensee can on their own say, well, we're going to log this area, whether you have a land use plan in place or not. So those are areas that we're looking at. A number of our organizations are looking at what provisions of the legislation need to be changed, and should we bring a constitutional challenge to that legislation. I'd like to see the government amend its own legislation to live up to the obligations that the Supreme Court of Canada said it had in 2005.
If that legislation was not in place at the time that TILMA was just passed, is it possible that TILMA could be used to prevent a new forestry regulation?
I'm not sure I know what TILMA is.
Well, that's the new free trade agreement that's been signed between Alberta and BC.
And so your question was, sorry?
Well, that gives the corporations that may have lost revenues the ability to sue the level of government for revenues that they would have made if they hadn't been forbidden to do something. And so I was thinking, well, okay, this law wasn't even in place, so if they try to put one in now, it might incur some kind of hook in the Tillman Treaty?
Well, compensation has been happening even before Tillma with logging companies, so a lot of logging companies have already received compensation for lost rights.
From the province?
Yes. Large amounts.
Do you know how much?
I can think of one licensee on Haida Gwaii who's received maybe $12 million in the last couple of years.
I'm not very knowledgeable about any of this. I was actually living out of the country for most of my life and came back a few years ago, and I'm just kind of hearing. But I lived in Japan for 30 years, and in the 80s I was involved in the anti-nuclear movement, and at that time I heard of the Haida for the first time because they came over to Japan and offered solidarity with us and also showed us presentations of some of the things that you've been talking about and introduced us to the worldview and to the feelings about the land and everything. So I've always associated the Haida with this passionate love for the land and desire to protect it and preserve it. And then I came back to live here and I hear about I just know what I hear. I haven't really studied anything, but I hear that there are Aboriginal groups who want to have the power over their own land, and then they feel that since they, that they deserve to be making the money out of it rather than other people having stolen their land and make money out of it. And then once they get the power over the land, they then let the logging companies come in and log it, and they get the money from it. That's putting it very simply. And I know that there are all different groups and all different politics going on within the Aboriginal communities, but it kind of disturbed me that giving the land back to the people who have the true rights over it doesn't necessarily mean that the land will then be protected. I don't know how to phrase the question, but I'm confused about what actually is, goes on in that area. What kind of struggles are there within, Aboriginal communities about what to do when they do get more rights over the land, and whether to protect it or to exploit it and make money out of it?
Well, it is a hard issue. In Haida Gwaii, the unemployment rates are in excess of 80%.
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
The unemployment rates are in excess of 80% on Haida Gwaii. So, my father logged in the winter and fished in the summer. So all of us have had that experience of engaging in that industry. But for us, we've come to a place in looking at trying to find a better balance between between the different values. Others will have a different balance. And I stay out of giving an opinion on whether that's right for them or right for us. I just know what's right for us as Haida people. And one of the proverbs that I think has guided us is, "The world is as sharp as the edge of a knife." And so it tells a story about a man who's walking along a thin edge of the world, and we see the world as a very thin edge. And because this person, in the story, he was actually just walking along a small raised surface, and he fell off that small raised surface and he died. And so the story tells you about that if you have one value that has given too much weight, then you fall off the edge of the world. And so it's about seeking a balance in all that we do. And so what we've tried to find is that balance between unemployment, the balance with protecting the land, the balance with keeping our families fed and back on the land. And I think that balance is different for different people. And I hope that if all of us are engaged in working with them, that together we can achieve a balance that's right for all of us. And I don't have a watch, so I don't know how much longer we have or whether...
It's up to
15 minutes.
Okay.
What do you think of the concept of a community forestry, a community forest that would unite all the communities? How does that stack up with the other things you've been talking about?
It is our hope that we would have a community forest tenure for all of Haida Gwaii, and it wouldn't just be for the Haida people, but all of the communities on Haida Gwaii, and it would benefit the local communities. And part of the reason why local communities were in favor of the Haida is that We didn't see any building of facilities. We have very poor hospitals. We have, you know, no facilities to support a community life. And so we want to feed back into the community, and we want to ensure that we're all collectively benefiting from the resources, if there is to be any benefit from the resources. We don't have a trial date set, and I don't know when we'll go to trial. So we're still in the preliminary motions.
You mentioned to me that you are also interested in the area of intellectual property right law, and I'm just wondering exactly, is that in terms of art, or where are you going with that?
Art and songs and ceremonies, so in intangible cultural heritage.
So are you in court things on that?
No, I've, working with UNESCO or bodies like that in creating definitions of intangible heritage, that kind of level, or exploring it for us, what it might mean.
Have you looked at the issue of intellectual property rights in the sense of patents on life?
I know that's a whole another area. I know some about it, but I'm not involved in that whole project.
I wanted to ask you a question. I don't know how to formulate it. When you first described the whole thing of the Haida perspective and began to speak in terms of the Salmon people and the language that you're using, I teach at SFU, and I find that when I try to express my views about, like, I'll talk about, sometimes I'll make expressions like protecting fellow critters on Earth and this kind of thing, trying to create some kind of perspective of a sense of responsibility for other living beings. Sometimes I get a reaction from students that this is a very unscientific perspective. And I'm very uncomfortable with the notion that science requires us to, there's one critique, which is, we can't anthropomorphize, right? You can't, so to say people, salmon people, it immediately sounds that way, right? So they respond. But at least the notion that these are fellow beings on Earth and we share this space and we have some kind of responsibility for making it possible for them to survive. Our own survival depends on it, actually, but what bothers me is that very often, it's not just a scientific perspective, it's also an economically driven perspective, so the only fellow critters that matter are those that somehow we can derive some kind of economic value from, or we can eat them, or we can do something with them, right? Not just because they're alive, they share this space with us, period. We should protect them, period. That's so beyond. What I'm trying to say is, I mean, you went to university, you got degrees, you went to law school. How did you deal with this question of this confrontation between these different perspectives? Did you experience it in that way? Did you find difficulty in trying to see things through a Haida worldview when certain things are presented as unscientific or impractical or utopian or whatever? Am I making sense?
I felt that I engage in a dual analysis of laws that other students might not have, other non-Indigenous students may not have. And how I came to see the primary difference between them is a view that in the dominant society that it's all about rights and not about responsibilities. And so if we see responsibilities married with rights, then we have a responsibility to take care of, whether you believe they're alive or not, or have another being, or have a soul, we have a responsibility to take care of them if we're going to be with them, or if we're going to eat them, or whatever it might be. The other thing is that economic values change over time. Cedar trees were once cut and left on the land because they were garbage wood, and now cedar tree is fetching huge prices on the economic market, so you never really know what is economic. It's a kind of a silly approach.
Yeah, I mean,
So.
So I'll take one more question, I know that things.
Are the HIDA at the treaty table, and if not at the treaty table, what were the choices about not going that route and taking a different route?
We are in the treaty process. We are at stage two, which is assessing readiness, and the next stage would be a framework agreement. We have not moved forward with that because the province wasn't willing to address the bigger, broader management issues at the negotiation table. So we had really no choice but to go to court. The other difficulty with the treaty process for us is the sort of positions that are brought to the table, especially the sort of cap at, is it 5 or 10%? When we already have 53%, it doesn't make sense for us to engage in a process that brings us backwards.
Yeah.
So, but we're willing to negotiate if those positions aren't there.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Terry Lynn, for coming in and sharing song and story and understanding about the soul of the land and how that understanding of the soul of the land has helped shape strategies around negotiation, litigation, and formation of alliances. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Flyers if you want one, putting your paper.